Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll discuss philanthropist, activist, and humanitarian Eartha White.
One of the things that I admire the most about her is how she really lived with the people that that she was serving, and she thought of it as serving.
We'll talk about the 2024 FHS Annual Meeting and Symposium.
This is the third year the Society has partnered with UCF College of Arts and Humanities and the Department of History to host the Annual Meeting and Symposium.
And the 2024 UCF Veterans Legacy Program. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Make this world a better place. If you can, reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world a better place. If you can.
Eartha Mary Magdalene White made the world a better place for African Americans living in Jacksonville through education, civil rights activities, the establishment of healthcare services, and more. Eartha White was born in 1876 and was adopted by a woman named Clara White.
Clara White was, a former slave, and she had had a number of children who had died.
Tim Gilmore is author of the book In Search of Eartha White, Storehouse for the People.
During Eartha White's time, there was this myth that was told, that most people believed, that Clara White had her 13th baby, and that this baby was kind of prophesied, and that this baby would grow up to become a storehouse for the people. That was the phrase that was used, and that was Eartha White. The actual truth is that Eartha White was the daughter of a man named Guy Stockton, who was part of the well-known and wealthy Jacksonville Stockton family. In fact, the Stockton family would go on to develop neighborhoods in Jacksonville like Avondale, San Marco, and Ponte Vedra. She was the daughter of Guy Stockton and a Stockton family servant named Molly Chapman. And so Clara had lost a number of children. And she and her husband Lafayette adopted Eartha White, raised her as their own. And Eartha White always had wonderful things to say about Clara, and ended up naming the mission that she and Clara started together in 1904. She later called it the Clara White Mission.
Eartha White was born in a time of enforced racial segregation, but Jacksonville in the late 19th and early 20th centuries had an active, inspired, and relatively prosperous African-American community.
There were several different parts of town that were thriving Black neighborhoods, and probably the best known one now is was a neighborhood called La Villa. Most of it is gone now. There are a few buildings left. People just think of it as a part of downtown now. It was once its own city, had a mayor and alderman, it had started as a plantation. And by the turn of the 20th century, and especially into the next couple of decades, it became a thriving, dense cultural place. West Ashley Street was full of theaters and musical venues, including a place called the Globe Theater that Eartha White borrowed money from other people because she was not allowed to borrow from the banks herself to use as the Clara White mission headquarters. But actually, it really all began in 1904 when Clara, Eartha's adopted mother, started a soup kitchen on Eagle Street, which is now part of First Street. And that was in a lesser known Black neighborhood just north of La Villa called Hansentown.
Eartha White graduated from the Stanton School, an important institution in Jacksonville's Black community. Tim Gilmore.
James Weldon Johnson, probably the most famous person ever born in Jacksonville, was a principal at Stanton at one time. And, you know, it's as you guys recently talked about on your show, you know, he was principal. It was there that he wrote, he and his brother, Lift Every Voice and Sing. In fact, Eartha White was part of an opera company, which is rather surprising. It was called the Oriental American Opera Company. And J. Rosamond Johnson, James Weldon Johnson's brother, was one of the people who ran it. But the old Stanton School was really one of the central, most prominent places, you know, for Black Jacksonville in that time.
After graduating from the Stanton School, Eartha White attended the Conservatory of Music in New York City and had a brief career as a singer.
Sometimes it almost seems like there's nothing worthy that Eartha White didn't do. I mean, just the most incredibly full life she did. And it's actually one of the things that I find most interesting about that is, you know, people have made a lot of the fact that Eartha White never married. And during her lifetime, people talked about her being married to the community. And there was this kind of narrative that she would never have had time for a husband. She was too busy doing good for the community. In fact, in 1970, she told a New York Times reporter, she said, "I never married. I was too busy. What man would put up with me running around the way I do?" But in 1920, she had been engaged. In the 19-teens, she had been engaged, and she would have married when she turned 20 to someone in Jacksonville named James Jordan, who actually died of tuberculosis while she was touring with the Oriental American Opera Company. And, you know, after that, there seems never to have been a prospect of marriage that she considered seriously.
When she returned to Jacksonville, Eartha White started a series of initiatives to help the African-American community, first working to build a new school and teaching.
She did so many things in this time period. It's just remarkable that one person could do all these things. She was hired to teach at a rural school outside Jacksonville. It's now within, you know, Jacksonville's consolidated city limits, but in a place called Bayard. And she was responsible for building curriculum and all sorts of things that you wouldn't necessarily normally think a teacher would have to do. But she also started businesses. She really was a strong product of Booker T. Washington's self-uplift ideas at this time. And, you know, as she grew the mission, the way I've always kind of thought about it is she kind of married Booker T. Washington's ideas with FDR's ideas, and it became just the center of just every kind of activism and community education in the city. Really quite remarkable how many things she did and how many things were going on at the mission at the same time.
Eartha White worked with other legendary people from Jacksonville, including activist A. Philip Randolph and author Stetson Kennedy. Tim Gilmore.
She worked with a few, names that are maybe better known than hers, but not necessarily rightfully so. She did work with A. Philip Randolph. She went and met with him in Chicago in 1940 when A. Philip Randolph was first proposing a march on Washington. And of course, certain conditions he was contesting at the time were answered. And so the march didn't happen then. It happened, 23 years later, of course. She had known A. Philip Randolph and she worked with him. She also worked on anti-lynching legislation. I find it fascinating that during the 1930s, the Clara White Mission actually also became a kind of partial headquarters for a lot of Works Progress Administration work. So Stetson Kennedy, also from Jacksonville, and his friend Zora Neale Hurston, they worked together out of the mission at times. Alan Lomax, the famous folklorist and musicologist, recorded very elderly at this time, former slaves singing old slave songs at the mission.
Following the success of the women's suffrage movement, Eartha White wanted to make sure that Black women were included. She also fought against voter suppression.
In 1920, when women got the right to vote with the 19th Amendment, she went door to door helping to register Black women to vote. And of course, so Black Americans could vote, but there were so many things in their way that Jim Crow laws had put up. But she went door to door, and she actually helped in this effort against a Ku Klux Klan intimidation parade that was held in Jacksonville. This is 1920, same time that similar parades were held around the state in Tampa and Orlando and other places. And of course, same time as the Ocoee massacre. So she helped the effort. She worked with the NAACP and actually James Weldon Johnson at this time to stand up to this Klan intimidation parade. On election day itself, she carried lemonade up and down election lines, and she led people singing old hymns and Lift Every Voice and Sing. So just incredible courage that I think is almost hard to fully imagine what that would have been like, that kind of courage.
The Clara White Mission still exists today and has evolved since its inception as a soup kitchen in 1904. Under Eartha White's leadership, the mission at various times included an orphanage, job training, prison ministries, and a variety of healthcare services. Although Eartha White was familiar with some famous people and received many accolades, she chose to live among the economically disadvantaged people that she served.
One of the things that I admire the most about her is how she really lived with the people that that she was serving, and she thought of it as serving, she maintained a bedroom on the second floor of the Clara White Mission, which people can still visit. It's maintained as though Eartha White might come back, at any moment. So she didn't separate herself from the people that she was always trying to help. She was right there with them, and they knew her, she was supposedly not quite 5 feet tall, and yet she had this larger than life kind of status. And I think it was largely because she didn't separate herself from the people. So, you can visit the bedroom now. And to me, it's almost a kind of sacred space, just to imagine this is where she was, and to look out the window and to think about, to try and imagine La Villa at all of these different stages of its history, even to know that, these are the stairs that she fell down when she went to the hospital for the last time and passed away at the beginning of 1974. So it's really kind of a sacred space to me in a lot of ways.
Tim Gilmore is author of the book In Search of Eartha White, Storehouse for the People. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the Florida Historical Society now holds two conferences every year, one in May and one in October. The 2024 annual meeting and symposium is coming up soon, October 18th and 19th, on the University of Central Florida campus.
This is the third year the Society has partnered with UCF College of Arts and Humanities and the Department of History to host the annual meeting and symposium. The fall conference is a no-frills event with a focus on emerging scholarship. Papers, workshops, moderated discussions, and lightning rounds of works in progress fill the multiple sessions focused on Florida history and culture. The first day begins with the Society's annual membership meeting to conduct the work of the organization. The morning and afternoon are filled with concurrent presentations. At 3:30, we will convene for a reception followed by a presentation by Dr. Andrew Frank, the 2024 Gerald H. Schaffner Lecturer on Florida History and Culture. Saturday morning will be another half day of scholarly presentations. History scholarship has changed considerably in the last decade. As has been true in the past, most of the work occurs in libraries and archives. However, in addition to papers, print articles, and monographs, scholarly work incorporates the digital tools that enable extensive data collection and assessment, data mapping, and digital presentation. A number of panels for this year's event incorporates these tools. Let me give you a sneak preview. Several panels highlight public history projects, which is community-engaged history, including a digital public history project with the Clio Digital Project to create a virtual tour of Florida plantations, a panel on the use of history harvests to collect community history, and a panel on the history and memory of Negro Fort adapted to the podcast. There are several panels focused on Florida's environmental history, including one that centers on women, food, and the environment. There are two panels on recently published scholarship on Florida, and two panels will be conducted by area university archivists, including a panel on archiving Florida's farm workers' community organizations, and one that features Rollins College and UCF Special Collections and the experiences of undergraduate students in the archives. There are papers on the Freedmen's Savings Bank in Tallahassee, and a panel on Disney and history. One of the papers in that panel is being presented by the new chair of the Department of History at UCF, Brian Miller. There's anti-apartheid legislation in Florida, and the intersectionality of indigenous land, reclamation, and Eatonville's pursuit of land justice, plus a panel on early 20th century Key West and Tampa culture, identity, and community as precursors in today's Latinx writing. That's to give you information about only a few of the panels and papers that will be presented. You can register for the conference on the Florida Historical Society website at myfloridahistory.org. There is no registration fee.
That's important that this is a free event. And Connie, as you mentioned, there's also the Gerald H. Schaffner Lecture on Florida History and Culture.
Yes, this will be on the 12th annual Schaffner Lecture. The lectures began with the statewide celebration of the 500th anniversary of the Florida landing of Juan Ponce de Leon in 1513. The Florida Historical Quarterly joined the celebration with the publication of annual special issues between 2013 and 2017 on each of the five centuries of Florida history. The Gerald H. Schaffner Lecture on Florida History and Culture was created in conjunction with the special issues to provide a venue for each of the guest editors to present a lecture on the century their work represented. Initially, the expectation was that the Schaffner Lectures would end with the completion of the special issues. However, the lectures proved so popular that they are now in their 12th year. The lecture series was named for Dr. Gerald H. Schaffner, Professor Emeritus, now deceased, who was a long-serving chair of the UCF Department of History and a nationally known scholar in Florida history, especially his work on Reconstruction. He was a past president of the Florida Historical Society and interim editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly when it moved from the University of Florida to the University of Central Florida in the 1990s. The 2024 Schaffner Lecturer is Dr. Andrew K. Frank, who is the Alan Morris Professor of History at Florida State University. He is an ethnohistorian who specializes in the history of the Florida Seminoles and the Native South. He is the author or co-author of 7 books, editor or co-editor of 4 books, and the author of numerous articles and chapters in edited books on indigenous people, including Before the Pioneers, Indians, Settlers, Slaves, and the Founding of Miami, which was published in 2017. He and Denise I. Bozzi co-edited the prize-winning special issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly on Indigenous Florida in summer 2021. Dr. Frank's topic is Seminoles and Miccosukees as First Floridians, an indigenous history of the Yugnefuski. The event takes place as the highlight of the annual meeting and symposium on October 18th. A reception at 3:30 p.m. will be followed by the lecture at 4:15 p.m. on the campus of UCF. The Schaffner Lecture is free and open to the public. We look forward to seeing you there.
I'm certainly looking forward to it. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Sebastian Garcia has this report on the 2024 UCF Veterans Legacy Program.
Alexis Wood is a fourth and fifth grade teacher in Orange County, Florida. I spoke with Alexis during the 2024 UCF Veterans Legacy Program, VLP, Institute, in St. Augustine, Florida. Alexis is a returning K-12 educator to UCF VLP, meaning she has participated in the program since the 2022-2023 school year. Alexis' continuity with UCF VLP enables us to assess the program from a broader, more complete perspective. In other words, through Alexis' experience, we can understand in concrete ways how UCF VLP's mission of honoring and memorializing veterans buried in Florida's national cemeteries in innovative and engaging ways legitimately materializes in the intended space and place, the K-12 classroom. When I spoke with Alexis, as with the rest of the returning K-12 educators, I replayed audio from our conversation the year before as a way to not only refresh their memory, but more importantly, to evaluate whether the classroom projects they developed for the following school year unfolded the way they intended. Alexis proposed a document-based question, DBQ, focused on women in the Vietnam War for her lesson plan. When I asked if such a concept was effective with her fourth graders, Alexis responded with the following.
It was extremely effective. The students, like I said, they really care about equity and raising up women. So they really dove in head first. And something that I did, kind of a tweak, I didn't have in the lesson plan, but when I presented it to my students to get them interested, I told them that they were going to become investigative journalists. And they're like, what is that? And so I'm kind of taking them through and just gassing them up about it, getting them all excited. I was putting some of these primary sources into manila envelopes that I had classified on it. So they were really interested in that, but they started to unveil these women's stories. And some of the presentations that they put together were just incredible. And I work in a Title I school. So it's, you know, typically students who receive free and reduced lunch. So they live in some lower socioeconomic living situations. Some are homeless, all sorts of things. And a lot of teachers, not a lot of teachers, there are teachers that I think kind of hold students back. They don't think that they can engage in these types of things. That's too hard for my kids. They can barely read. Those types of sentiments. And I was able to do this, and every single one of my students produced a great product. Amazing the way they were able to go through those primary sources. I mean, they were going through with a fine-tooth comb like we are for our biographies. They were like little mini versions of us, and they were again clamoring for more. I think I would do the exact same thing, which I'm kind of planning for this year's lesson plan, another DBQ, same principles. Now I'm going to be looping up with my class from fourth to fifth, so they'll get a new DBQ experience, a new topic, and I cannot wait to see what they'll accomplish now that they've already had one under their belt. I think it's going to be amazing.
The second VLP classroom project, or deliverable, was a mini tour of St. Augustine National Cemetery. Alexis did not conduct an in-person tour of the cemetery, but implemented a virtual tour in her classroom. Alexis' mini-tour focused on the Seminole Wars, an often overlooked conflict in Florida and American history. Her students connected deeply with the assignment.
We are primarily doing it for a fourth grade, fifth grade audience, so we had to kind of use kid gloves, for lack of a better term. So definitely giving reverence to the land and acknowledging that this was their home, and helping the students kind of understand what happened to these people, how they were forced to assimilate, how their lands were ripped from them, their culture, everything, the families torn apart. So kids really connect with that. a lot of them were, they hated Dade. They were like, he's the worst. Oh my gosh. And, you know, so a lot of talk about him and not liking him. I overheard a group of students talking about it during recess. And we hadn't even talked about it that day. We had done it like 2 or 3 days beforehand. And they were still talking about it amongst themselves during their free time. And I felt like that was a highlight.
All participating UCF VOP K-12 educators are assigned to research and write a biography of a World War II veteran who died in service during the war and is interred at St. Augustine National Cemetery. Part of this deliverable is so K-12 educators can use their biographies as a model when teaching their students how to research and complete their veteran bio. As we have heard throughout the segment, Alexis learned from her experience last year to produce a more effective product this year.
I feel way more confident this time around. I feel like my biography is a lot more fleshed out this year compared to last year. The research process was not as daunting. I feel like I was able to go through and gather incredible information to really build this veteran's life. So my experience last year was just so necessary, I feel like, to get to the level that I wanted to push myself to in writing. And it's just made this whole experience easier, kind of knowing what to expect, knowing the caliber that we need to write to and research to, and just the level of care that it takes. And I feel like I did a great product last year, but this year I think I really, you know, hit it out of the park. My veteran this year was Jerry Palms. He is a Florida-born person. He was in the Army. He was a captain in the 222nd, and he went on over to the European theater. He was working along the Rhine in Germany, fighting against the German forces there, and there were quite a number of battles that he was engaged in. The ultimate one that he was in, he was leading and organizing, and while he was doing that, he was in an exposed area on a tank, and he got hit by enemy fire. So unfortunately, through his efforts, he lost his life. However, that allowed his regiment to go on and liberate the Dachau concentration camp.
For those interested, numerous veteran biographies, mini tours, and lesson plans covering various topics and conflicts are available on the UCF VLP website at vlp.cah.ucf.edu. To learn more about Alexis Wood, her UCF VOP experience, and the overall significance of the program, please listen to Episode 5 of the 2024 UCF VOP podcast series, releasing later this fall wherever you get your podcast. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.